Welcome back. It's Reef Threads Podcast 148. I'm Gary.
And I'm Christine.
And we are very excited this week to have with us Ken Niedermeyer from the Coral Restoration Foundation and returning guest Rich Ross from the Steinhardt. Hi, Ken.
Hey, how's it going, Gary?
Hi, Rich.
Hey, Gary, how are you doing?
Good to have you with us. Thanks to both of you for joining us this week. Reason that they're both here is we want to talk about the tremendous work that the Coral Restoration Foundation is doing and share with listeners who don't know about it where it's going, what it's accomplishing. And this is all Ken's baby, and we want to people need to know what they're doing. And then Rich is with us because just before MACNA, he was involved in a dive where they hit the spawn just right, and he's going to help us tell us what they did and where they're going with that and what they did with the larvae and what it's like to be in the middle of a spawn collecting larvae or gametes and making larvae and doing all those things that they do. So, you know, whatever it is you do. So let's just start out. Ken, tell us what is the Coral Restoration Foundation? When did it start? Why did you start it? What's it do?
Okay, well, the company itself started in 2007, and it was kind of a response to just watching the coral reefs die. I was a tropical fish collector for 30 years here in the Florida Keys, and I was watching the corals dying off and fewer fish because there wasn't as much coral for them to live in and around. And I was frustrated and didn't see a lot happening to do anything about it. And kind of, you know, a long story, you know, I basically, my tropical fish background led me to aquaculture, coral farming, and next thing I knew, I was running a nonprofit. I had no intention of doing that 10 years ago, but it's funny how things change. And so I started growing corals on an offshore live rock farm. I had the first live rock farm on the east coast of Florida. And coral settled on the live rock, and I started thinking about, you know, what could I do with these corals other than just sell them? And I did think of selling them, but it just, this idea of using them for restoration just kind of took hold in about 2001 or so, and it just kind of went from there.
So you were one of those people who had some space in the ocean and piled up a bunch of rock and let it get colonized and then sold the rock?
Yeah, we started our live rock farm in 1994, so we were selling live rock for a long time, and we have thousands and thousands of corals settle on the live rock all the time, but most of them are just, you know, kind of, you know, brain corals and star corals, and, you know, nice corals, but, you know, the interesting one would be the, you know, some of the fast-growing Acropora corals, and we had staghorn corals settle in 1996, and so that was that got my attention. It's never settled since then. We've never had any new recruits onto the live rock site, but we did have it that 1 year, and we've managed to keep those corals alive, and that kind of just opened a lot of doors and led to a lot of interesting things. I never did sell any of the coral. I started growing it to sell it, but never did sell any. Started, you know, my passion just went towards restoration. I don't know why, but just frustration of watching it die, I guess.
Yeah. So you started this foundation, and primarily you're growing elkhorn and staghorn coral?
Those are the main ones, but we are growing other corals. We just got a permits from the National Marine Sanctuary Program to start with several of the, what used to be Montastria, some of the star corals, also working with sea fans and brain corals. We get a lot of the recruits that land on our live rock site and put them onto discs and grow them and then plant them on the reef. So we've got about 17 or 18 different species of coral, but the ones we're really going to be working with are the staghorn, elkhorn, and then some of those star corals.
And why are you choosing those ones over some of the other ones like the gorgonians that people would normally associate with Caribbean reefs?
Well, historically, people would have associated elkhorn and staghorn coral with Caribbean reefs, but they've pretty much died off. About 95 to 98% of the historic population is now gone, so people don't associate that with the Caribbean reef anymore. They associate it with the weeds that grew after the coral died, which are the, you know, softies. So yeah, we're trying to put it back to what I remember in the, you know, early 70s. And, yeah, and the other reason is that they grow really fast. They're easy to fragment. They grow real fast, and there's a big need. So it just seems like a lot of things come together. People ask me, why aren't you growing, you know, the other corals? Why aren't you focusing on them? And it's just hard to get people excited about a coral that grows from a, you know, maybe a golf ball size to a softball in 10 years. That just doesn't excite a lot.
You, you're working in some pretty protected water. You must have had to jump through some major hoops to get to a point where you could actually plant coral on the reefs.
Yep. Seems like every other year or so, we've got another big hoop to jump through. The first hoop was just to be able to put anything on the bottom, and then to put it into, you know, protected areas, and then to collect more different genetic diversity, and then to do it on a bigger scale, and then an even bigger scale, and now on a huge scale. And every step of the way, it's been another long, drawn-out, you know, permitting process. It's just, you know, it's a bridge that's never been built, you know. So once you build the bridge, you can cross it, and other people can cross it. So that's kind of what seems like, you know, even the live rock was the same thing, you know. But it's worth it to get it done. You know, you look back and you see the accomplishments, and it's, you know, it's pretty exciting.
And as part of this whole thing, you've had to develop methods of growing coral. Now all of the frags that you grow out into larger size colonies. You're doing all of that in the ocean, right? None of that on land and then transfer to the ocean?
Yeah, pretty much everything is done in the ocean, 3 miles offshore and 30 feet of water. So there's definitely some challenges. You know, we certainly have watched the aquarium community to see how they do it, used a lot of the same tools and epoxies and things like that. But we've had to improvise, had to, you know, take a lot of other, you know, hurricanes are obviously a danger. You know, we get sharks and turtles and all kinds of stuff that you have to deal with.
What fragmenting protocol are you using now? Because I know I've seen your lectures over several years now, and it seems like it's morphed several times in different ways, from suspension culture to gluing things down. So what is it that you see as working the quickest right now?
Yeah, that's a good point, Christine. We started with, you know, everything growing on, you know, large frag plugs, which are, you know, like hockey pucks, that size frag plug. And then we went to a, you know, little squares and then little triangles. But everything is suspended now. We build these trees. We kind of invented this idea of growing the corals on in trees. I mean, other things have been cultured on trees, but to my knowledge, corals hadn't been. And so we started growing them suspended, and they grow so much faster, at least twice, maybe three times as fast suspended as they do on a disc. So everything is grown on, you know, suspended on these trees, and really grow like crazy.
Why do you think that is? Is it a flow?
I really don't know. It could be flow. It could be more food. Could be, you know, light. It's hard to tell. As soon as we put a coral, if we take a coral from a disc and put it up on a tree, it could be only a foot higher, maybe. Usually it's more than that, but a foot or two higher, and it'll turn a dark brown color within 2 or 3 weeks. I mean, the color changes fairly quickly, and then they just start growing faster. So I everybody asks that question. I don't have all the answers.
When you suspend them on the tree, you're just using monofilament line, fish line, to hang them off the tree?
Yeah, it's that simple. We were using wires for a while, but the wires were failing. They were vinyl-coated wires, but they were, you know, abrading and breaking after 9 months to a year, and so that was a kind of a catastrophic lesson learned. So we use monofilament now, different grades of monofilament for different size corals. It's real cheap, real quick.
And the corals just grow right over that filament, and
they grow over the monofilament. We hold them on. You know, monofilament is like we call it a little crimp or a swedge. They grow over that. The monofilament gets grown over in a week, maybe 2 weeks, and then they start growing up the monofilament. They'll have a 2 or 3 inch chimney growing up the top. So it's pretty neat.
Hmm. And so then you just cut them off. You don't try and remove the monofilament. You just cut them off. No.
Yeah, we just cut it flush, right at where the coral has stopped growing. We just cut it there, and it grows right over the top of that. And then we just plant the whole thing on the reef.
Hmm. Let's see. One of the things that we've talked about you many times on the podcast, and I, too, have followed you. And I wonder, you got some years into this now. Some of the original plantings that you did, some of the original reefs that you started to restore, what are they like now? Have they really started to grow and fill in?
Well, we started, and it's only been up until the last year or so that we've been putting large quantities down. Some of those earlier corals, just about all of them after 5 or 6 years have, for one reason or another died. I know it doesn't sound like a great success story, but sometimes the original coral dies, but then all the little pieces that have broken off it over the years still growing. We started out planting just single corals here and there, and they get really big, and then after 5 years, it seems like they die from the inside out. They get that rapid tissue necrosis or rapid tissue loss. So some people say, oh, that's horrible, that's a failure. Well, it sounds like a failure, but we've learned a lot. One of the things up until just this last year, we were only dealing with 3 different genetic strains, the ones that had settled on our live rock farm. So we have no history of how they really did or would have done out in the wild, on a natural reef. So what we've done over the last several years, 4 or 5 years, is we've collected samples from a existing colonies, wild collections, and we've looked for the colonies, the corals that are doing really well in the wild, and taken those back to the nursery. So my feeling is, as we start planting those corals on the reef, we won't have that 5-year drop off. I don't know whether that answers your question or not, but if they had survived and continued to grow, it would be awesome. But unfortunately, those earlier corals have not done so.
Ken, do you think that the way that you're growing them in the frag stage has anything to do with why they're doing well or not doing well? Because if you start them out in a treat culture and then you glue them down to a substrate at the bottom, do you think that that somehow makes them susceptible? Because you're dealing with very different types of dynamics?
No, most of the corals that up until maybe a year or two ago, every coral that we grew was grown on a disc and planted mm-hmm. out there. So they weren't suspended corals. So that, we've been planting the suspended corals for the last year or two, and they've done really well. So, I don't think the growth, the way we grow them, has anything to do with it. I think it has a lot to do with the location on the reef, and also it could be the genetic strain. So we're trying to tease that out. We have 105 different genetic strains in our nursery of just staghorn coral, and just the one nursery. We have 5 nurseries, so I'm sure we're going to find some winners. And I think that some are going to do well on some reefs, and some will do well on other reefs. And I don't think it'll be consistent. So I think we just have a lot to learn. Just because you don't wildly succeed the very first time, you don't quit thinking, oh, this doesn't work. There's ways to make it work, and that's what I'm determined to do, is figure out how that's going to happen.
Hey, Ken, have you had discussions about boundary layers in regards to coral growth?
No.
I would suspect that the corals in the trees do better because of a lack of a boundary layer. A boundary layer is the layer at which the water moves slower and slower as you get closer to the substrate. So, an inch above a frag disc, the water moves much faster than a quarter inch above the frag disc. So when you suspend a coral, there's no boundary layer. So the coral is getting the maximum flow that it can possibly get. And I would suspect that's got something to do why the corals on the trees grow so much faster. And it may be worth experimenting out on the reef, putting some kind of pedestal to get the corals up actually off the reef, so they've got more flow around them and they don't have to compete with the currents moving over the substrate. They just hit the coral itself.
Yeah, so that's interesting you say that, because I've been pondering that whole thing. It's like, why are these corals, you know, they get to this critical stage and it just seems like we can't get them past it. And it could be that, you know, in a thicket, sometimes you go into the Caribbean. I've been in places in the Caribbean where you see these big thickets, and sometimes the bottom corals, they're huge, they're fat, but they're dead.
Yep.
But this layer of coral up on top is just as healthy and happy as can be. And so, you know, we're doing our planting a lot different. I have thought of building a frame out there and growing them up on a frame. And certainly something to think about, because I'm sure that flow and water circulation, all that kind of stuff down on the bottom has an impact, because they start dying from the bottom and work their way always.
Yeah, that's how the reefs actually grow. And I think we as aquarists often forget that the corals grow to a certain size and then the underparts die off so new coral can continue to grow. I'm making all of these great gestures with my hands that are completely useless in a podcast. But that's how the reefs actually get bigger, is that the corals underneath, they stop being alive, so stuff can get up and out into the water flow where there's more flow, oxygen, and nutrition. So that's interesting. I think it would be worth looking into to see if you can get them up above the reef surface just a couple of inches and see what happens.
Yeah, and I think you were you with us on the MACNA dive? No, I guess you weren't. So one of our strategy now is, instead of planting these individual corals, we're still planting, you know, individual corals, but we're clustering them and then stacking them.
Yeah.
You know, we glue a base layer down and then come back in a week and stack them on top of it, and sometimes get, you know, a couple, 2 or 3 feet high. And, you know, if you can get them big enough and the bottom dies, it'll still be strong enough to hold that upper layer. And then, so sometimes it's just a matter of size. And so, you know, this grant that we're starting this next month, I mean, we're literally going to be putting thousands down in huge mats and building them up high and just see if that will make a difference. I think it will. I mean, it's certainly an interesting way to do it. And we've never had the coral to do that up until just the last year or two. So, you know, if you've seen the nursery, I mean, there's just tons and tons of coral there.
Yeah, the difference between this year and last year is astounding.
Yeah, and it'll be, you know, if we could keep it all suspended in the trees, it would be triple that next year or more. I mean, it's just unbelievable how fast it's growing out there. So we have a lot of neat things we can try.
What I like about this discussion is, you know, we heard at MACNA from several people about the challenges of raising marine fish in captivity, and it's clear to me now that it's rebuilding reefs in the wild, which seems like such a simple thing, grow coral, put it out there and it'll grow, isn't any easier than raising fish in captivity. There's this huge learning curve, many things that need to be tried before you can finally, hopefully, reach a solution that really, really takes off.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And, you know, and I think some areas, you know, you could probably have a lot better success than others. I mean, here in the Florida Keys, we have a lot of things, you know, a lot of stressors, a lot of challenges. You know, the reef has, a lot of the reefs are just so far degraded, you're starting all over. And, you know, it's difficult, but I'm very optimistic that, you know, we're going to succeed. We're going to figure this out. And we have a lot of different people helping us. You know, Rich is, you know, one of those people, you know, comes down. He's got a lot of great observations. And then this work with spawning corals now is, is a whole nother facet of, you know, trying to restore and recover the species. And, you know, it takes a group of people working on it.
The group, speaking of groups of people, the number of people that are actually directly associated with the foundation is fairly small, yet you need a lot of people to do this work. Where do these people come from that do all the diving and planting and just all of the hard work in the water?
Yeah, so right now we have 4 paid staff, including me, and we also have about, don't know, 10 or 15 local volunteers, you know, that live in the Keys, and they, you know, some of them are retired, so they put in lots and lots of time. And then we have dive clubs, aquarium clubs, just people that, you know, dive and have heard about it. They come down and participate on, you know, these regular trips that we do. And then we have, you know, we have people from all over the country that just have been down several times, and we've gotten to know them, and they come down and stay for a week and dive their brains out with us. And so we, you know, like today, I think we had two paid staff and two volunteers, but usually it's like one paid staff, you know, one, you know, staff member and four or five volunteers on the boat just about every day it goes out. Sometimes we have two boats out. So, yeah, we have a lot of people that are wanting to help out, and we can't do it without the help. And the, you know, the goal is to try to train more and more people and give them, get them to take ownership of different reefs. You know, the goal maybe in the Keys would be to get people up and down the Keys, taking care of these corals that we put out there. We found that if you take care of them, you know, pick the algae or the coral eating snails off them and, you know, replant broken fragments, you can make a huge difference. And so just kind of training that army of volunteers to help out and to take ownership, I think, is part of our strategy.
So there literally is aquarium maintenance out in the ocean in terms of, because I was going to ask you, what are the biggest drawbacks you have in the water in terms of getting these things to grow? So you've got people out there just basically doing gardening then.
Yeah, I mean, it's like if you if your city comes in and plants trees along the highway and then never waters them, they're, you know, they probably die, maybe not, but you know, they'll do better if you take care of them. And that's what we're saying, is these corals will do better if somebody takes care of them occasionally over the first year or two. And then after that, you know, they, once they kind of reach a critical basketball size corals, they're pretty hardy. A snail is not going to kill them. Four or five snails are not going to kill them. You know, a fireworm is not going to kill it. So, you know, it's getting it through that first year that we're trying to get people to help us with.
Yeah, I live in a city that believes in the waterless tree growth concept. And, yeah, it's fun to watch your tax dollars sit out there. Are the natural the natural predators, the urchins and other animals that need to be there to keep the reefs clean, are they starting to recover too, or is that still a shortcoming?
Well, the diadema sea urchins, you've probably talked about Martin Moe and his work with them, and I've worked with him on it too. And they're like the groundskeepers of the reef. You know, they're the main herbivore, and they still have not recovered. And yet today, it was interesting. I was diving in an area where there was quite a bit of natural staghorn coral, and the bigger thickets, a lot of them had a diadema or two living in underneath it, which is encouraging to see that. Because, you know, I think the fish and the sea urchins play a real important role in the, you know, the reproduction and the health of the corals, and I think it's important to get them back. So I'm seeing a slow recovery. It's painfully slow. In some areas of the Caribbean, they've done really well, the recovery, and those are usually areas where there aren't any fish left to eat them. Unfortunate.
Yeah. So, where are you headed with this thing? What are your immediate goals? What are your long-term goals with the foundation?
Well, we have this a new permit from the sanctuary that we got last year, and it allows us to put 100,000 corals, a little over 100,000, like 105,000. Corals on the reefs of the Florida Keys. So we're working on that. We're gonna work on that till it's done. The permit will go for four more years, and then we can renew it if we need to. So that's, you know, that's Keys wide. We have a program in Bonaire down in the Southern Caribbean. We have a fisheries down there and a restoration program that's, you know, moving ahead full steam. We have one in Colombia. We expect to be in Grand Cayman and Roatan and Tortola over the next year, you know, setting up nurseries, training the local people and getting, you know, long-term restoration programs going there. So we want to train other people, you know, all through the Caribbean, really anywhere, you know, how to do this, you know, how to do it successfully. You know, people are not selling the corals. These are corals that are going straight into restoration. And yet, you know, this is growing them suspended is an awesome way to grow. You know, somebody want a coral farmer wanted to grow some serious coral. This is the way to do it.
So, how big are these nurseries? How many acres?
Our nursery, the biggest one we have out here, it's probably about an acre, maybe just a little under an acre. And there's about 35,000 corals growing. And these are, you know, a lot of the corals are big corals. You know, the basketball size are bigger. So it's not 30,000 pinky size frags. You know, it's a lot of coral.
Wow. That's impressive.
It's a lot of work to keep your hands around it, too. You just can't do it.
Yeah. Now, and one before we get off of this part of the podcast, I definitely want to talk about funding and money. You need money, and you need plenty of it, I'm sure. Where is it coming from? How can people contribute?
Well, we're applying for grants, and we just got a NOAA grant that could go for 3 years. We also got, a grant from Disney Worldwide Conservation Fund, and we got a small grant from SeaWorld. So we've gotten some grants like that that they certainly help, but we get a lot of sponsorships. People can sponsor a mooring ball. We don't put the mooring ball in for them, but there's existing mooring balls, and the sponsorship is basically, we'll plant corals and maintain them around that mooring ball, and we'll call it yours. And we're working on trying to be able to put even a sticker on it, so for a company or even an individual, we could put a sticker on the mooring ball, restoration at this mooring ball sponsored by Gary Parr, So that's another way. And then the industry, the marine life industry, the reef keeping industry has really stepped up to the plate on this for a long time. So a lot of the companies that everybody knows, Two Little Fishies, Boyd, Ecozotic, Ecotech, Foster's and Smith, just a lot of different manufacturers like that have sponsored sites and are doing some really big stuff for us. World Pet Association sponsored a site for $25,000. It's basically a whole reef. And so that's, that kind of stuff is just awesome support. And then people adopt corals. They help, there's a lot of ways. And a lot of times people say, oh, well, he must be making a ton of money and, somebody else will donate. You'd be surprised how few people really, write a check or send in any kind of payment. People always assume that somebody else is going to do it and, doesn't always happen.
Yeah.
So if you're listening, don't think that somebody else is going to pay this bill. If you want it done, you got to get involved.
And I think. Yeah. Go ahead.
No, that's.
I was just going to say that I think that this is a no-brainer for hobbyists and clubs to get involved with. There's so many pressures on the hobby, and people don't know what to do to help out. And what the Coral Restoration Foundation is doing is such a compelling story. You've got 90% of corals gone from the area. Coral Restoration Foundation is bringing them back, and we can all help. So it's a great story. It's succeeding, and I think more clubs and smaller organizations. I would love it if everyone would get together and start actually trying to help the oceans rather than just making sure we have animals for our tanks. And I think what Ken and CRF are doing is just a no-brainer, great cause, great entry-level way into the field of doing more for the oceans that we need for our corals and our fish. And so I'd love to see more people get involved.
Yeah, we would too. And people actually can get involved. That's what's kind of different too. Not only, funding and support is critical, but, the people that dive and even some of the people that don't dive, they can come down and see it and frag corals underwater and hang them and plant them on the reef. And, what other, I think it's, that's neat, but this is a story that came out of this industry, and we're leading the pack. People, the world is watching what we're doing down here, and it's a cool story. So I think it's great for the industry to get behind it and say this is our story. Don't let somebody else take it.
Yeah, I had a email exchange with a listener earlier today, and he had been in Hawaii and said that he was seriously considering getting scuba certified, and the reason for it was to come down and help you guys. And
well, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it just spoke volumes to me about the impression that you've made at least on one person, and what you're doing for the reefs, that a person would have that as a focus, as opposed to I want to do this so I can go on a diving trip to Palau or wherever. And that one really kind of got my full attention, that was what he was looking at doing once he got certified. So,
you know, we had a group down right after MACNA. There was some of the sponsors like Boyd and Piscine and Two Little Fishies, you know, people that everybody knows. And then we had a bunch of hobbyists that had won this trip that those groups were sponsoring. And it was just so much fun to get in the water with them, because they love coral to start with, and they love fish, and they love this whole thing. And then for them to get in there and frag these corals and see this farm underwater, and then put corals on the reef and glue them and see all this happening, I mean, they really got excited. And I got excited watching them. They're not just the average diver, man. They're reef keepers, and it's different. It's a lot of fun to be with them. I had a great time.
Yeah, and speaking of reef keepers, Rich, you were there the week before MACNA. You guys had some great success. Tell about that, what you were doing, and what comes out of that effort.
Well, the Florida Aquarium, in association with TEN and the Coral Restoration Foundation, has been doing some spawning projects down in that area for the last, I don't know, what, 6-8 years, Ken? It's been a while.
Yeah.
And there's also some other researchers down there, Lori McLaughlin and Margaret Miller. There's a whole lot of interest academically in what's going on down there. But what the Florida Aquarium wants to do is kind of the same thing SeaCorps wants to do, is kind of focused on the sexual reproduction of corals, because it's great to have, you know, fragments of corals, but they're all, you know, genetically the same. They're all clones. And to make the ecosystem really robust, we want there to be genetic diversity. So the whole idea is to bring aquarists down. We have people from Florida Aquarium, Academy of Sciences in California, SeaWorld, Disney's Living Sea, Akron, Mystic Aquarium, a whole bunch. And the point is to collect coral spawn and be able to take that spawn, bring it on land, get it fertilized, and then get it settled, and then grow those corals back up. And the ultimate would be to grow those corals back up and then get them back out onto the reef. That's a step or two away, but I think we're getting pretty close to it. And that way we have more genetic diversity. And ultimately what we could do is make sure we're collecting spawn from two different genotypes of coral that we know are going to be a robust mix, and actually choose which ones we're putting together and make sure we've got hybrid vigor and all that kind of stuff going on. So that's the goal. The goal is to grow corals and then eventually be able to grow them well enough from spawn, sexual reproduction of corals, and then get them back out on the reef. And last year we went down, we had very little success with the spawning out in the wild. Although because of the association with the Coral Restoration Foundation, we brought some corals into the lab and they spawned for us in the lab. So this year when we went down, we were going to hit it on both fronts pretty hard. I think we had 14 parent colonies that we brought onto land into Ken's lab. And it was great because Ken actually went down and checked to see if the eggs were staging. So we weren't just randomly picking corals. Ken was checking them to see that they had eggs that seemed to be coming up. And we brought those into the lab, and those spawned for us really well. That was really great. But then the biggest night was, one night everything went off. All the corals spawned, the cervicornis and the palmata, the staghorn and the elkhorn, just tons and tons of gametes, and it was just phenomenal.
And when that happens, what's that like? That's just got to be madness underwater in terms of trying to collect the gametes and keep up with it. I mean, it must be just an incredible adrenaline rush to be part of that.
The dive that we did I was in the water for the big spawn night. I was actually out on Molasses Reef, and that is one of the top 6 or 8 dives of the 700 dives I've done. It just built so amazingly wonderfully. We hit the water. We didn't see any signs of the coral setting yet. And setting is when you see the eggs starting to come out of, or staging to come out of the corallites. So you're looking for that. And we were able to photo document that in the cervicornis this year, which was something that we had on our goals, because sometimes it can be really hard to tell what's going on. last year, you know, we didn't have, there were no pictures we could find of it anywhere. So we thought everything was coral setting.
It was all ready to go every night.
Yeah, every night, every coral was ready to go and none of them went. So it was crazy, because what we do is we tent the corals with a collector. And when the corals spawn, it just kind of automatically goes into this little collection cup. But if you think everything's ready to spawn, you're moving the tents from coral to coral because you're hoping. But now that we've really seen the setting, you know, it's a lot less hectic underwater because you know it's going to go because you see them getting ready to go. So what is it like on the dive, I think you were asking, is it's very calm. Nothing seems to be going on underwater. It's just a regular kind of calm night dive. And then as things start to set, all the rest of the animals on the reef kind of know about it. They don't kind of know about it. They absolutely know about it. You start seeing lots of plankton, lots of mysis swimming around, lots of those palolo worms. Those worms are kind of amazing. You touch them and they disintegrate, and that's one of the reproduction strategies. So, I mean, literally this giant foot and a half long worm can be swimming at you, and it touches something and it just disappears. It just turns into mist. It's amazing to watch. And then the fish come in. And then you see the brittle stars crawling all over. I got to work on those pictures, crawling all over the corals that are setting. And the larval fish come in and the bigger fish come in. We had on Molasses, you know, huge barracuda, lots of them. And that's pretty freaky to get this big silver thing 5 feet away from you that you don't see till your light hits it. We had turtles on the reef that night. We had a reef shark that was bumping into people because we had schools of squid. Just kind of everything kind of goes nuts, and you can really feel the energy of the animal life on the reef building up as the spawn approaches. And then on nights when you're there without it, you go, absolutely, this is the difference. The same kind of biological energy isn't there. So. And we got tons of spawn that night. It was fantastic. And we got on the boat, and we heard that the nursery was spawning, and we heard that the lab was spawning. We just had spawn everywhere, and it was awesome, awesome, busy night. I think we all got to bed around 5, and then we were up again. And then we were up again at 7. So that's what that week or 2 weeks is like. It's just work all the time. There's always something to do. You set up all the tanks and everything, and you get all the corals on land. But that's just the start, so it's pretty amazing. And then, do you want to know what would you like to know? Because I've talked for a long time.
After you collect the gametes and get them back to land, yeah, I'd love to know what do you do? What's the next steps?
Well, what happens is what comes out of the coral is a sperm and egg bundle, and in the cervicornis there's like 8 to 12 eggs, and then a whole bunch of sperm, and they start to break up within an hour. So you get them on the boat and you race them back to land because you want to be able to mix different genotypes together because the corals won't self-fertilize. You can't just have, you know, the sperm and egg from one coral and put it together. You won't get corals out of that. So you do have to cross-pollinate them, as it were. So they break apart, and then what you do is you start to separate the sperm and the eggs. And it's really nice. The eggs float and the sperm sinks. So you use these gravy separators, which has got it's like a pitcher except the spout's at the bottom. And you, as the sperm settles to the bottom, it doesn't really settle, but as it starts to sink, you pour it off and it only pours the sperm out. And then you can keep putting fresh water into that kind of pitcher and keep pouring it off. And you'll end up with clean eggs and concentrated sperm. And then this is the best conversation ever, isn't it? And then you have You have like buckets of sperm, and I know that sounds weird, but you just, really just do.
Remind me not to have Thanksgiving at your house.
We use plastic gravy boats, not China.
Okay.
And then you start mixing sperm and eggs together, and you put them together at the right consistency, which is kind of a lemonade kind of color. Although this year we're finding that the more concentrated the sperm was, the better off we were having fertilization. But too much sperm is bad. Then they fertilize. You leave them together for about an hour, and then you rinse the fertilized eggs off again, and then you put them into these coral rearing tubs, which is kind of like a sideways chrysal, you know, that moves jellyfish around. And you have these fertilized eggs, and they float on the surface for a while. And we set up some sprinklers at the top to keep them from clumping together or from getting stuck on the sides of the tubs.
Yeah, let me stop you there. You were talking about how these sprinklers really changed dramatically that whole process, because last year, what was it, every 15 minutes you had to go in and agitate the surface of these sideways chrysals? Was that what it was?
Yes, exactly. Because
we call them roscillators.
Oh, no, stop.
Richard's the one that came up with the idea.
I didn't call them roscillators, but you can.
We did call them that.
Not me.
It's a trademark now.
So the fertilized eggs will stick to each other and clump, and then they won't do well. And then they'll also stick to the sides and won't do well. So you have to kind of gently move them with a pipette. If you're too rough with them, they break up. So the idea was to put the sprinkler, just like a little rainbird sprinkler, for like a micro garden. And it shoots a 360-degree sprinkle, and that kind of rains down onto the sides of the sideways chrysal and keeps washing whatever would be collecting up at that meniscus edge, like on your test kit, though, keeps washing it back into the middle so it doesn't stick. Also, hey, nicely... Rich. Yeah.
Can I interrupt you for 1 second? Has anybody ever thought about, and this may be a completely stupid idea, but that's what I specialize in. Has anybody ever thought of using any kind of biologically safe surfactants to keep them from clumping and to keep them from sticking to the edge like that? Because then you won't have that meniscus.
I haven't heard of that. But this is, you know, the serious looking into this is, you know, really started, as far as I know, and I don't know everything, that's for sure, with C-Core. So that's about 10 years old. And I think we're at a critical point now where we can start really experimenting, because I think up until the last couple of years, we've got spawn. Finally, we've got spawn. Everything worked out. We spent all this money and all this time, and we got it. We're not going to mess with it. We want to make it work, and we know that having somebody stir it every 15 minutes works.
Yeah, this is a really new field. And the thing is, you know, these things only do their thing once a year. So, you know, you wait a whole year and, you know, you don't want to, you know, it's just, you don't want to put anything in the water that might kill them. So it's a real frustrating thing. And and you don't get a lot of chances, and so you certainly don't want to do anything at all. Like Rich said, you'd rather sit there and stir it all night than to take a chance with something else. But I think that over time, we're going to try more things. And, Rich didn't go into it much, but I'll just jump in for a second here. But, you know, last year, I think just having people like Rich and a lot of these other Aquarius together, I mean, you know, we said, you know, we've been doing the same thing for 2 or 3 years now, and it's not working. We need to come up with something different. And so we just started thinking way outside the box on how to get these corals to spawn, and, you know, just a lot of things that we thought of last year, and we put them into action this year. It just so happens that everything worked well this year, but I think next year the processes that we've developed we're going to hit pay dirt next year too. I just think that this year was a real important year, and so I think we'll be able to experiment more next year, because I think we're going to have confidence that we're going to get some spawn. We did some experimenting this year, some really cool stuff that some scientists have been waiting for a long time to do. This was the year that it happened. So I'll let Rich go back into his monologue.
let me get back to Rich for a minute. Ken, while these guys are diving and collecting bundles, what are you doing? Are you diving too, or are you back on land supervising and getting ready for when they come ashore?
Floating around, napping.
Okay, good.
No, I mean, usually I'm out there taking pictures. I'm right there with them. You know, I'm in it. You know, this year I was busy. I had several other things going on during the day. I didn't get to get out every night, but you know, a lot of what I've done is just get the corals ready. And like Rich said, I've sampled them and I said, this coral's going to spawn, this one isn't. Now you guys do your magic. So, I mean, I wasn't as hands-on this year as I have in the past, but it doesn't, you know, I don't have to be there every night.
Yeah, and we have teams out on the reef, we have teams at the nursery, and we have teams on land. So you need people at all places. I just want to say the coolest innovation that happened last year was we had a coral in the lab spawn, one genotype, but that was it one night. And because it was CRF and Ken, we knew we had other corals with eggs in them of different genotypes. So what we actually ended up doing was harvesting eggs and sperm from the other coral, harvesting them right out of the coral. They didn't spawn. We extracted them, and we were able to put them together. The C-section. I like it, a coral section. And we were able to get fertilized larvae from that. So that was a desperation move that worked. And we were all ready to be able to do that again this year, but we didn't need to, which is even better. So I think we are now going to see more and more things being tried. You know, Ryan Chaya had a bucket. He just used a Tupperware bucket, and we called it the misfit batch. And he just took stuff from all over the place and just put it in a Tupperware container with two air bubblers in it. And, man, if that stuff didn't do just fine, you know, it wasn't anything crazy. So we may end up finding, and wouldn't this be great, that it's really just not that hard. You just need to keep it kind of moving and the stuff will do just fine. Of course, that may be a fluke as well. You know, it could, you know, this is science. So next year, nothing could work. It could be a complete, you know, frustrating year next year. I'm with Ken, though. I think we're in really good shape. And we're all getting sleep now because we have the sprinklers. So
yeah. So once you have these larvae on land and they start developing, one of the next things that should be involved, I assume, is recruiting zooxanthellae to colonize those corals. So are you selective about that, or how does that work? How do you choose?
Well, how do we choose? We choose what we got.
Yeah.
You know, we can get some frags. If they're going to be reintroduced to the reef, they've got to be inoculated with zooxanthellae from corals from that area.
You can't.
You'll never be able to get it back out again. So that's what you'd want to do. We ended up taking some of these corals home. We weren't even prepared for that. You know, we weren't prepared for the success of the spawn that we had. But luckily, we had a permit with some of the corals, Caribbean corals, with NOAA already. The Steinhardt Aquarium did. And we called them up and said, look, we're really successful here. Can we amend our permit to get more corals to bring the larva back to California? Actually, Steve Bitter from Florida Aquarium called them for us, and it was great. And they were really helpful and were able to amend our permit. So we have some stuff at home now, or here. Where's here? Here in California, where I am. I just checked one of the bins yesterday, and we have settled corals in there. So that's great. And I know Florida Aquarium is definitely using inoculations of zooxanthellae from corals from the Keys. So those are going to be the best shot if they can get them through the next year, possibly to get them out. We also have some plans to talk to Ken about you know, stuff, but we'll have to talk to Ken about that in the next couple of weeks to see if we can make that happen. But yeah, the zooxanthellae, you know, that part of it's not, I don't think, as well understood. You know, every year you get a little bit further in the process and you understand more and more and more. And the stuff that was you know, Sisyphusian at the beginning was just impossible to do, now we can do. So now the next part is we just want to grow these corals up so we know we can do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we start playing with the genetics and making sure we're growing the right ones and the ones that, you know, we want to put back out on the reef. So I think this is just going to get better and better pretty rapidly at this point.
And at the Steinhardt, what do you have settled corals now? What is your plan? Is it just simply to get them to grow and see what happens and learn from that?
That's the plan for the ones at the Steinhardt. I don't think we're going to be able to reintroduce these if we're successful. So because of the problems of being last minute and cross country and all that kind of stuff, I think we're already contaminated with Indo stuff. But just that we were able to do it and grow them is going to be a huge success, I think. And if we can replicate that over and over again, it's awesome. So we're going to have these corals. We have a 4,000 or 5,000 gallon Caribbean display, and hopefully they'll grow out. We can put them in there. We can also share these corals around to other institutions that are doing Caribbean corals if the NOAA permit allows us to do that. So, I want to make sure we can do it, you know, and we can grow them up long term, that they're not going to crash out in 2 years, which has been what's been happening somewhat. You get a couple years of growth and then they kind of don't do well. And we don't know what that is. So I want to get good at our part of it, which is keeping these things alive and growing them up. And then once we're good at that, start folding the science back into it and making sure we're getting Ken what he needs to repopulate the reefs of Florida.
When they don't do well, do they don't do well in the same way in different places? Because I know that these corals, the larvae, now have been all over the place. They're in Omaha. They're with you in Florida. Do they all kind of crap out in the same way at the same time, or is it just they happen to fall prey to different things?
It's different things. I haven't seen a rhyme or reason for it. Mm-hmm. You know, you get them a couple of years and then they ADR, they ain't doing right. And,
right.
Like corals do sometimes. Uh-huh. And, you know, even with growing them up, so you've got these little one coral-like corals, they're going to need light, but when you start giving them light, then you start getting algae problems. And when you have, you know, then you need herbivores that aren't going to destroy a tiny, tiny one coralite coral.
Mm-hmm.
I know there was somebody who put a fox face in there to take care of them. The fox, to take care of algae problems, the fox face just went and ate every single polyp, which had to be incredibly distressing. So but you know, how would you know that unless you tried it? And I think we're really at a step change in how everyone's approaching this and an experience. And I think, like Ken said, I think it's just going to get better. I mean, we're seeing hobbyists having spawns in their tank now, right? We're seeing that more often as well.
Yep.
So imagine we can start getting hobbyists with two different genotypes of the same coral, spawning them and raising them up together. That would be super cool. That's something a club could do.
Yeah,
that would be awesome.
Yeah, this is something I don't think that people fully understand is when you guys do this work, I mean, you're just everything has to be done with a permit and approvals from whatever agency is overseeing things. I mean, that's got to be quite a huge part of these efforts to have your permits and make sure you stay within the bounds of those permits.
Absolutely. If you don't do it within the permits, it's worse than cheating. It's doing a disservice to the whole process. And I don't think makes much sense for there to be, you know, vigilante science. I think it's the you know, people want to say that the permitting process is too hard, but it's not too hard. It's just something you have to do. And you know, the people at all of these governing bodies, even at Fish and Wildlife, they're not mean people. They have rules that they need to follow and that you need to follow, and you just need to do it. You know, like I said, we happen to have a permit, and they were really, really helpful at amending it. They didn't need to be that helpful, but they were. And getting that initial permit was work, because it is. It's you know, protected animals, and we should protect protected animals. So, yeah, it's work, but I think it's worth doing.
Yeah, it's worth having the permits too, because, you know, if you go to all the work and you haven't done it in the open, then you can't really talk about it. And so you've really wasted your time. And I've, you know, we've been in everything we've done in the Caribbean and everything we've done in Florida has always been by the book and legal and upfront, and, you know, so we can brag about it. And I've heard of people, you know, say they did this or that, but they really can't talk about it in public. They can't, you know, it's not a story because it's all kind of behind the scenes. It's all black market type stuff. And I don't want a story like that. That's not a story that I can sell, that I can be proud of. So you get the permits. And like Rich said, it's not that hard. They're, you know, these people are doing their job, but they're on our side. I mean, they want to see progress made.
And Ken, when you're doing work with in Bonaire and the Caymans and some of these other island countries, are you finding them equally supportive of your work and willing to give you the permits and assist you, or do you find resistance?
There's actually resistance. We have to reinvent the wheel every time we go to one of these places, because most of them are government bureaucrats, and they really haven't been paying attention to this. And, you know, in their mind, you know, this touching coral kills coral. So there, you know, we have to sell them on the idea. I think it's getting easier and easier, because now you can say, well, you know, check us out, or check this whole thing out on the internet, and they can, and they're saying, oh, okay. So they have to check us out to see whether we're legit or not. And when we're first starting out and don't have a long track record, it's a little more challenging. But it, I think it's getting easier because we have a history now. And but they're usually skeptical to begin with.
Yeah. All right, we're going to wrap this up. Boy, Ken and Rich, really appreciate you guys taking the time to share this with us. And obviously, we encourage every reef club and every hobbyist, if you have a way to help out this effort, please do so, either by going down there and doing some diving, contributing some money, talking about it, telling the story, so that others will appreciate the work that people like Ken and Rich are doing. It's just important. It's our way of giving back to the reefs that we depend on for our hobby. And so thank you guys for taking the time, and we really appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Gary.
All right.
Well, thanks for having us.
Yep, and with that, we'll wrap up Reef Threads Podcast 148, and we'll be back next week. Thanks.
Take care.